You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
All right, welcome back to The Link on our afternoon edition, coming to you live from COA. We are now joined by Angela Storseth and Dr. Deborah Pat from Texas Oncology.
Thank you so much. And we are so excited to have Dr. Pat on our podcast today. Dr. Pat is pretty much a part of our policy team, but she is an oncologist at Texas Oncology. She is on the COA board. She does many other things and wears many other hats. She's very involved in DC on advocacy. She is well known at the Texas State Capitol. When she walks in, people know that there is a big healthcare bill that's probably up that focuses on something that could impact community oncology.
Well, I'll say, Angela, it is so important for us to be engaged because I do believe that our elected officials have the best intention of providing great healthcare for their constituents, but sometimes their background doesn't allow them to understand the details of how policy influences healthcare. And that's why it's so important for healthcare providers and the people that support us to be engaged at the Capitol.
It's so true. And I will tell you, this conference has been amazing so far. We're broaching about 2,000 people here. And right from the opening session to several of the breakout sessions, the common theme is around advocacy. The keynote speaker spoke about it. There is a lot of touch points. Can you talk to us a little bit about our work that we're doing together on the state level in Austin, but also how you kind of see all of that through your lens of being involved with COA and our impact across the U.S.?
Sure. So I'll say for me, the issues at the federal level and the state level, while there might be different issues in different areas, it's all really a similar theme. And that's that our elected officials do want to have their constituents have great health care, but sometimes they don't understand how policy impacts healthcare. And it's important to enlighten them about the challenges you have in providing cancer care to patients in their district, in their state, so they can then make good decisions to try to facilitate good healthcare choices. Because sometimes you might have a policy that seems very clean and seems like it will have the intended consequences that you would like, but you don't realize there are these unintended consequences that could manifest, that could do things like decrease access to cancer care, prolong the time that it takes for a patient to get treatment, diminish the quality of a patient's treatment, put a patient at risk for adverse outcomes. So, you know, I think that engaging at the state and at the federal level really is more about education than anything else. And I found our work together has been most effective, I think, when we have developed relationships with policymakers, because as we educate them about the cancer care ecosystem, then when a bill is up for consideration or an issue is up for consideration that is very specific and niche for healthcare, they already know that we're an established resource for cancer care. And we can serve as an expert in that way, because you can't always foresee what will happen 2 months from now that will need your immediate action. And so I think establishing those long-term relationships is really important. And again, at the end of the day, there's not a single elected official that wants bad cancer care to be provided in their district. And so I think that generally speaking, we're quite aligned.
Yeah. And it for us, we just had our big Texas Oncology Day at the Capitol a few weeks ago. We brought around 37 members, from physicians to our pharmacists to our oncology liaisons. And our big focus was bringing the patient focus back into policy. Policies and our top priorities that really emphasize the importance of patient safety, patient timely care, patient access, but also quality of life for patients, because we're seeing a lot of policies from payers, from the insurance companies that really intervene with that. Can you speak a little bit to some of those priorities that we're focused on that has that patient focus?
Yeah, so some of the state priorities that we're working on are things like prohibitions for mandates on white bagging. The reason why that's important is when we treat patients with cancer, that usually works that a patient comes in, they get their laboratory values, you see them in clinic, they go on to the infusion room where they get chemotherapy. Now, the reason why you see them and why they do labs beforehand is because sometimes patients have toxicities from chemotherapy that require dose adjustment. They may have their kidney function diminished, manifested as an elevated creatinine. They may have their liver inflamed, manifested as increased liver function tests. They might have increased neuropathy on clinical exam or a progression of their cancer that you detect on physical exam. All of those things require an abrupt change in your treatment. And every day when an oncologist is in clinic, you make some dose adjustments to chemotherapy based on efficacy and toxicity. So you make those last minute adjustments. If we were mandated to white bag, then we wouldn't be able to make last minute adjustments in chemotherapy because that chemotherapy would have had to have been shipped days before, already pre-mixed, and we wouldn't be able to make last minute changes. So prohibitions on white bagging mandates is really about patient protection, avoiding unnecessary waste, making sure patients can get the care that they need. And aside from those very direct issues, there are real supply chain issues because, you know, these aren't just drugs that are mixed, right? Many of them are biologic agents that are grown and they have to be kept at a very specific temperature. They can't be kept at a temperature that's out of range. Otherwise, they're no longer active. And so giving them to patients would both be could not be efficacious and could potentially be hazardous. So a lot of very specific issues related to cancer care. So prohibitions on white bagging mandates are really about how we provide the best quality of cancer care that we can for patients in the community. Those are some state issues that are going on right now. Another state issue that we are advocating about in Texas is around access to care. So in Texas, we have a high percentage of uninsured patients. Right now, they're looking at and considering changes to some of the Medicaid programs for cancer. So when patients are diagnosed with certain cancers, they might have more access to care. So right now, the Texas Medicaid program funds the breast and cervical cancer program at 200% of the federal poverty level. They're making a consideration at 250% of the federal poverty level. And there's discussion about an emergency Medicaid program for colorectal cancer. So as we look at Texans with cancer, I think those efforts would go a long way to help protect vulnerable Texans whenever they get cancer, so they have access to appropriate cancer care, which would be great and really meaningful. Some of the other things we're working on are biomarker coverage. So when patients have active cancer, like say if you have a lung cancer, over 60% of those patients have some kind of an actionable mutation. And that mutation being identified, whether it's a MET mutation or an NTRK mutation or an EGFR mutation, those very specific molecular mutations can translate into very specific molecular therapeutic interventions. So it's like finding the lock and the key instead of just treating cancer with a blunt instrument. So we want to identify those locks and keys. The challenge in doing that is that payers don't always cover for some of the molecular diagnostics and things like next generation sequencing, or if they cover some, they don't cover all to be really therapeutically relevant. So that that piece of legislation is really important because it provides patients access to the lock and key mechanism to better control their cancer with less toxicity.
You know, Dr. Pat, I was going to laugh at something with you a little bit that you might find interesting is several states are looking at the biomarker testing coverage bill.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that some states, when they're doing their outlook of it to get the fiscal note to understand how much this would cost the state, states like Colorado have somehow gotten in lumped with this, the 23andMe or a lot of the ancestry type testing, they're bulking in with the biomarker testing and they don't really understand the difference of that. So back to your point on just advocacy and why it's important for us to have a seat at the table, that's a little bit humorous to us because they're completely different.
Yeah, you know, you sit there as an oncologist, I sit there in the thick of cancer jargon every day. And so, it, you know, like the back of my hand, I know the purpose of next generation sequencing. If there's a lung cancer that has a target that's going to treat it specifically with a pill instead of chemotherapy, people are going to want the pill that's going to be more effective than the chemotherapy that's more toxic and less effective. And so, like, those differences are part of my day every day. But for many of our elected officials who might have different backgrounds, maybe they were in sales before they went to public service. Maybe they were attorneys and had nothing to do with healthcare. You know, frequently they don't know very much about cancer care, and that's not insulting. It's just that they, you know, they've not been exposed to it. So really, as we want to be effective advocates, some of the best things we can do sometimes is to provide education. And that way it empowers them to make more informed decisions to help their constituents.
And it's very common for there to be misconceptions, especially when we're talking about maybe testing and things like this. So I understand how there could be that misinterpretation, but it was our organizations and our advocates that are there to explain this to the legislators, that they're able to get it squared away, and then we're able to get the appropriate fiscal note. And not including, you know, those types of
inappropriate testing that we wouldn't ever think to cover to manage cancer care. Absolutely.
I did want to ask you about another priority I know we're focused on. And after hearing our keynote speaker today, it sort of opened up the discussion to really think about it, because he really took us into his experience that he had having testicular cancer twice and then cardiac arrest at 34. And this is Dr. Will Flannery that we're talking about, who's our keynote speaker. You know, fertility preservation is something that we have talked a few sessions in Texas about coverage around that. I think the focus is a lot on for women, but what is your sense on that? You know, you being an oncologist focused on breast cancer, the perspective from a man when he was talking about it today and thinking through, you know, is he going to be able to have children after his second time to have testicular cancer?
Yeah, it's a really important issue, Angela, because, you know, while we've had these amazing innovations in cancer care and the majority of people survive their cancer journey and will go on and thrive and live normal lives, if we don't think ahead of time for young adults to preserve their fertility, they may lose the opportunity to be biologic parents. And for many people, that would be devastating for them. And so as an oncologist, we have an opportunity to think about that ahead of time. We have the opportunity to preserve fertility. I will say for men, that's easier and cheaper than it is for women. But as a breast cancer specialist, I treat many young women with breast cancer, and many of them that have gone through fertility preservation and that have gone on to have 1 to 4 children after their pregnancy. And I have to say, I mean, after their cancer treatment, and I have to say it is the most remarkable thing. And it's what gets me up in the morning to see that not only did we get this person past what was the scariest day of their life and the scariest time of their life when they thought they could die, but to be on the other side of breast cancer treatment where the overwhelming likelihood is that they're cured. And then they get to be them again. They get to live their life. They get to be teachers or doctors or lawyers or, you know, administrators or whatever it is that they do. They get to have children. They get to, you know, have life be their adventure again. So I think that preserving fertility is very much a part of that. And it can even be medically helpful. So sometimes when I meet patients that have a strong family history of cancer, they might harbor a mutation that increases their risk. So it has happened to me many times in my office that someone says, Dr. Pat, I know I have a breast cancer, and my mother died of breast cancer, and my sister died of breast cancer, and my aunt died of breast cancer, and this will never again happen to my family. I'm not going to have any children. And to be able to tell them, you know, we have the ability for you to do something different. If you want to do fertility preservation, we can choose to do selective implantation of eggs that don't have that gene. We can test for the gene prior to implantation, and then they can change their life story. So now some people choose to do that. Sometimes they don't. That's not my place to say, but to educate patients, to empower them to have a life that they want, to fulfill the life that they want, it's so important to support their survivorship, especially for the adult young survivors.
Well, Dr. Pat, we really appreciate what you do on the state level for advocacy. And I know, JC, you are probably really excited to get Dr. Pat talking about her big testimony that she recently just did in D.C. So,
yeah, Dr. Pat, tell us a little bit more about that so our listeners. Dr. Pat was actually in D.C. a couple weeks ago. Well, she's in D.C. quite often. Dr. Pat is a very big advocate, and we love to have Dr. Pat and really appreciate her speaking out on several issues in the cancer community. But recently, she was actually on a panel in the Senate Commerce, Transportation, and Science Committee on a PBM legislation led by Senator Cantwell on a hearing that was looking at addressing more oversight into PBMs. As many people already know, PBMs have been a really hot topic as of late, especially in Congress. So, Dr. Pat, why don't you tell us a little bit more about that experience and more about that bill and everything related to that?
Sure, JC. So, as you probably know, there's a tremendous amount of vertical integration in the payer landscape between payers, pharmacy benefit managers, specialty pharmacy, and then sometimes even clinics and care delivery. So PBMs and their specialty pharmacies, the top three are the large majority of the market.
It's about 80%, right?
Yeah. And I think if you get the top six, it's like 94% of the market. It's really, there's a lot of consolidation in the market. So the bill under consideration that Senator Cantwell is championing in the Senate Commerce Committee was about transparency and accountability for pharmacy benefit managers. Because a challenge that we have in that marketplace today is that there may be many financial opportunities that PBMs have that direct patient care that are not, that people don't understand very well. So, you know, PBMs might set restrictive formularies, and we've seen the increase of that practice over the last few years. Those restrictive formularies are likely related to rebate structure. But we don't know anything about the rebates. We don't know anything about what exactly insurance companies are paying for the drugs in comparison to what employers are paying for the drugs. So, I think that that transparency and accountability would solve some of that and would make it apparent where we needed to have policy changes. I will say, in addition, today there's a lot of steerage that happens to vertically integrated PBMs and their respective specialty pharmacies. The natural consequence of that in cancer care is that we have a lot of unintended medical waste, because when I start a patient on an oral oncolytic or a pill that treats cancer, that's about a third of the therapies I give today and will probably be 60% in the next 3 years. When I start that pill, frequently I have to dose adjust it based on toxicity. So when I see the patient at 2 weeks or 4 weeks, I might say, you know, this dose is too high for you. I need to decrease it. But if the patient has had their pills steered to a vertically integrated PBM, they've already sent them that second month of treatment. Mm-hmm. And so they have to waste that month of pills, which might be $12,000 worth of pills. So it leads to a lot of unintended medical waste. Or if their insurance cover company won't cover it again, then the patient just doesn't have therapy. So, it's challenging because we're really particular. You know, these are therapies to kill cancer, which are cells that naturally occur in your body. So giving exactly the right dose is critical. You know, we have to give just enough to kill the cancer, but not enough to kill the patient. And if we don't do that well, then patients either have adverse outcomes because of toxicity or adverse outcomes because we don't effectively help the cancer.
Yeah. And I think part of the issue itself is that we're still trying to figure out, you know, what is the best solution, right? What is it? I think right now one of our first steps really into it is, you know, where's this more oversight into the PBMs? How are they really operating? What would you suggest some of the solutions and steps that, you know, Congress or the administration could take in addressing some of these issues that you guys are facing, you know, every day in your practice?
There's so many. I mean, I think one issue is transparency and accountability. I do think that's actually the most important issue, because I think it heightens awareness to where the dead bodies are buried, if you will. And so I think that's the most important. And I'm happy to say that the Senate Commerce Committee passed that out of committee earlier this week. So that's great news. But there are other things. You know, right now, clinics are that have medically integrated dispensing are penalized. We have post hoc fees called direct and indirect remuneration fees that are based on quality measures that have nothing to do with the quality of the care that we provide. So that's something that's grown tremendously over the years from about 4% of total costs 5 years ago to about 11% of total costs today.
Yeah.
It's tremendously expensive for the practice, and it's an expense that one can't predict. So that's a challenge. I think steerage is a major challenge. I think that there should be prohibitions on forcing patients to steer. I think that medical wastage is a challenge. So all of those things are issues. But I think that the biggest issue is around transparency and accountability.
Yeah. And I think so. I think that's probably one of the bigger topics, especially right now in Congress, is related to PBMs. We saw the House Oversight Committee recently launch an investigation into the top three PBMs, trying to see, you know, what exactly their how their behaviors are operating. We've seen some letters from many members, Representative Buddy Carter, who we spoke about earlier on this podcast, related to TRICARE beneficiaries, looking into exactly how some of those PBMs are operating their reimbursement rates and negotiating that with pharmacies, and how TRICARE beneficiaries are able to get the coverage they need. And so I think this is something that there's this really big appetite in Congress, and hopefully there'll be some movement this year. What other issues do you think at the federal level that are really a hot topic right now that you think we should all be looking at?
I think something that's gotten a lot of attention recently is the 340B program. Mm-hmm. The 340B program was originally designed by HRSA to allow narrow resources to be spread further and to try to have vulnerable patients benefit. A whole group benefits from 340B, everything from federally qualified health centers, black lung clinics, Ryan White clinics, and then disproportionate share hospitals. Of those, I will say there's been a recent public concern that disproportionate share hospitals may not be using that program in alignment with its original intent in all cases. And I think that part of that is the $91 billion in 340B that it was, you know, purchased in 2021. So, you know, there's been tremendous growth of that program. There's been growth because of the contract pharmacy relationships. And so in the news, and the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, there have been multiple articles articulating instances where hospitals that have the 340B program have refused to see patients that are vulnerable that don't have insurance. So, you know, I think that's a real challenge. I think that there's growing appetite to make sure that we protect the 340B program in alignment with its original intent, not impacting it for those federally qualified health centers or clinics, but really to be looking at the disproportionate share hospitals and where there's not an alignment between the intent of the program and operationally what it looks like today.
Yeah, because I think that's almost over a 30-year program that has, you know, seen many changes throughout the year. And I think there's an appetite to make sure that the intent is still being met, that underserved populations are making sure they're getting the care that they need. So as we wrap up, one thing I really just wanted to sort of tell some of our listeners, if they really want to get involved, you're very active, you know, you've testified both at the state and Congress. You know, somebody who's interested in getting more active, what would you suggest be their first steps to do that?
So I would say if you're a doctor, get in touch with your legislative policy group, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you're a U.S. oncology doctor, get in touch with you guys.
Yeah.
Make sure to participate in dinners in the district. Be there for a Hill Day. If it's not with your, with you all, then, you know, with your professional society or with others, because it's critically important. Either we are at the table or we are on the menu.
Yep. And I feel that's something that is definitely always being discussed. Definitely having to make sure that your voice is always being heard, and with physicians and being able that close touch point with patients, being able to advocate for them and your practice and your work is something that members of Congress and both at the state and federal level definitely need to hear. And as you mentioned earlier, it's all about that educational piece and making sure that every piece of health policy that they're looking to do, that they are aware of those unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And I think you guys, with your expertise and your work there, seeing patients every day, it's very important.
Well, we're a good team. The truth is that none of us practice in a silo. I couldn't do work without my practice administrator, my medical assistant, my nurses, my nurse practitioner, my pharmacist, my lab tech. Yeah. You know, I need all of these people, just like I need you all to help me be a better advocate. You know, we have to be a team for cancer care. And I think that at the end of the day, there's no one that wants for patients to have bad cancer care. And so even though there can be, lines by chamber, lines by party, really, you know, cancer care is something everyone can identify with and no one is against.
Yeah. And so one last thing, too, is we're here at COA. We have about less than a day, half day left. Anything else you're looking forward to at the rest of this conference?
Well, today are the policy updates, actually. So we'll have the state and federal policy updates. And I'll say, I think we have been instrumental in helping to craft that narrative. You know, so Angela and I have been working very closely with the state group and the federal group with COA. You know, we're all a partnership in a team. It's interesting because, you know, when you look at practices, people talk about, you know, competition in a practice. But I will tell you, in this regard, we are all on the same page. Again, trying to advocate for great cancer care in our communities. It's so nice to be aligned with these people that are trying to help make meaningful change. And, you know, we are all in this together.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pat, for your advocacy, for your participation, your engagement. You are a force. I love being with you at the Capitol. I love being your sidekick.
Same.
So thank you so much. And we're excited to see what happens at the rest of COA.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Link Podcast, your link to the legislature. For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.